History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. And of course, our goal is always to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to then try to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we find that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. Each story is unique, and the Silver Star recipient we're going to hear from today lied about his age to enter the military at just 15. Bob McCoy is 91 now and lives in Fairfield, California, surrounded by quite a few fellow military retirees at Paradise Valley Estates. But he grew up in a different part of the country. Bob, what can you tell us about your hometown of Colton, South Dakota? What kind of place is that?
A town of about 1,700 people, and we lived 3.5 miles outside of town on a farm. And my mother was born there. Her parents were both 100% Norwegian. They came over, and they got gifted 160 acres by living there and making some progress on it. And so it was a quarter of a section of a land. And that's where my mother was born, and that's where I was born.
What do you remember about those childhood years? I imagine life was a little different than what kids experience in Fairfield, California today.
I don't remember a hell of a lot about it. We lived on a farm, and I can remember a tornado come through, and we all went to a cellar where we kept this stuff in the wintertime or in the summertime to keep it cool, because we didn't have any electricity or any running water or anything. Tornado came through, and we could hear the horses screaming, and we lost two lambs, our favorite little lamb. It took the roof off our barn and put it out in the field, and I used to drag my wagon out there because the roof was still fairly intact, and I'd drag my wagon out, and I'd drag it up on top, and I'd come down and ride that wagon down over the shingles. I can remember that. I was probably about 5 or 6 years old, 7. During that period.
And I imagine those winters get pretty cold and windy there.
Oh, I was born in December 1932 in one of the worst storms for that year, evidently. No doctor, no phone, no heat, no electricity, of course. And my mother's sister came there to visit, my Aunt Louise, and she was the one that delivered me because they couldn't get a doctor or anything there. So. I was delivered by my mother's sister, Aunt Louise. My mother died when I was about 6, maybe 6.5. I was stationed up in Alaska when my Aunt Louise died, and I came home on emergency leave for her funeral.
What happened to your mother to die so young?
She was 39. She was having birth. She died of the birthing. I guess. I really don't know.
Do you remember, as a boy, having some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, here's who I'm going to be or what I'm going to do?
No, but I remember watching the airplane come by and say, I want to fly someday. But that was a few years later. We had moved to a new location, a little farther north, I think it was. I used to remember, I would go out and crawl up on a straw sack on a Wednesday night so I could probably see the airplane a little earlier than I could down at the ground level. And I would watch it. Sometimes you could hear it first and then you'd find it. It was kind of interesting. It was a DC-3.
Well, and I'm curious, too, because you mentioned, you know, you had a brother that was much older who actually served in World War II, survived the Battle of the Bulge. You know, being at home and having a brother overseas that you didn't know if he was going to make it back or not, was that something that weighed on you?
No, I didn't know much too much about that, really. I had two older sisters also between my brother and I. They both got married. It was just my dad and I, and I was about 13, 14 years old, and that's the reason I kind of signed for me when I was 15. I filled out the paperwork and said I was 17, and he signed it, and off I went.
And I've interviewed a few guys like you. In fact, you have your own organization of underage military veterans who were so motivated to serve that you lied about your age. What was the motivation for you at 15 years old to twist your dad's arm?
I tried at 14, but they said wait till December 5th so you'd be 17 or so that your dad could sign for you. I had to lie. It was just my dad and I, and we would go by for my evening meal was a ring of bologna and a box of crackers, and he'd be drinking a beer at the little service station. And that would be our evening meal. And he'd give me a couple rings of bologna and a couple of crackers. And I could sip his beer, though.
So for you, getting into the military meant a better life.
Oh, yes. It was truly a dream come true. Mm. When the train left Sioux Falls heading for Chicago to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, it was 3 days after Christmas, the 27th or 28th of December 1947. I get to Chicago. As soon as the train left Sioux Falls, it was over 43 miles from where I was born, so as far away from home as I'd ever been.
And you ended up seeing a fair amount of the world in your Air Force career, huh?
Yes, I did.
I haven't seen any pictures of you at 15, but I have to imagine some people knew you had a little bit of a baby face, and you probably weren't prepared for some of the things you dealt with.
Right out there, there's a picture of me at age 18, I think.
What was it like for a 15-year-old in the military? Are there some moments that you look back on and that was kind of a rude awakening or a welcome to this new life?
Well, when I first started out in Fairbanks, Alaska, they said, do you want an inside job? I said, well, yes, I do. So they made me an 055, which is a file clerk. But I didn't know anything about filing. But I didn't need to because I was the general's janitor. My first 2 years, I was a general's janitor, and I had a little cubby hole with a sink and my brooms and mops on the wall and the buffer sitting over here, and I had a nice easy chair, and I could study for my high school equivalency test. That's what I ended up doing. Mm-hmm. So I got my GED test done. That's the reason. And then the Korean War broke out, and they lowered the requirements for getting into pilot training from 2 years of college to a high school equivalency or high school education, and I got my from Wisconsin or whatever the place that Air Force had my equivalency, and I managed to get into the aviation cadets.
What did it feel like to finally have a chance to fly, to be at the controls in the air?
I tell you, it was a beautiful thought. My dream came true.
Do you remember the first plane you went up in?
Oh yes, yeah. I got my pilot's license up in Fairbanks, Alaska, but it was just a little cub for my first plane. I took my private pilot's license in Luscombe, and I did it 31 March 1950. I just turned 17 in December, and you had to be 17 before you could get your private pilot's license, so I did that.
So as a civilian, you were 17, but in the Air Force, you were 19.
No, I told them about my age when I was in, and I got redlined from basic training. I had to get my father's death certificate, my mother's death certificate, my dad's signature, saying he would never mind me being service anywhere in the world. There was four of us that got redlined, and I was the only one that got to stay in the service. I don't know why, other than there was signed by a Benjamin R. McCoy, Major General, head of Air Force personnel. No relation whatsoever, but I didn't know that until 8 years after I'd been... My wife and I visited a place on the East Coast there, and I got to see my records. And there was that letter. But I found out that it was my approval was signed by Major General McCoy. It explains what this captain that I was whitewashing all the rocks waiting for my assignment was treating me. I didn't have to whitewash another rock when he got that letter. I was approved for retention in the service.
What a journey. And, you know, I'm thinking back to... You're sharing that your first job in the Air Force was the general's janitor in Fairbanks, Alaska. Did you ever mention to that general that you wanted to be a pilot or that's what you were going to do someday?
I don't think I ever talked to him. Mm-hmm. I talked to his secretary only. I think his name was Gail Gaffney, was his name. Mm-hmm. I haven't really checked that out, but I remember that just all of a sudden it came to me.
Since that first time in the air, how many hours as a pilot have you put in?
Oh, I got a record of about 26,750 hours on record, but I probably have a few more hours than that because I flew my own airplane quite a bit, and I didn't really log all the hours I've got in it.
And can you give us a taste of the array of different aircraft that you've been in the cockpit of?
In the civilian or military. We started out with a little Super Cub for primary pilot training, and then basic, and we went to the T-6 at Bainbridge, Georgia. And then I went to Laredo, Texas for final pilot training, and I flew the T-28 and the T-33. And then I graduated in the top 5% of my class, so we could supposedly go get our first assignments. And so I put in for F-86s, and I should have had it, but they said, nope, we're going to take it. The top 10% is all going to go to the instructor school. So I ended up going to an instructor school. And then while I was there, they were opening up a course for senior officers because the Air Force was turning to a jet Air Force, but all the senior officers had no jet time. So we started a school at Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas. There's 12 second lieutenants and 2 first lieutenants and a captain. And we started a school, and we started getting 12 students every 2 weeks. And my first 2 were full colonels, and then I ended up with a major general. And he brought his VB-17 up there and had it parked on the ramp, and I gave him his first dollar ride, as we call it, free ride, you know, type thing, because we had a little 8-ball there, and if they forgot something, they had to put 50 to a nick quarter or 50 cents in it, and then we used it for a party at the end of their thing. He says, okay, you showed me what you've been flying there, Lieutenant, now get in the left seat of this one. So his IP, he had to fly with an IP in the B-17, was in class with him, and his name was Captain Gray. But when I finished with him, he was Captain White.
I'm not the first person you've used that line on, I know. So I'm just thinking about this. The irony of the guy who, a couple years earlier, is the general's janitor, is now teaching generals and colonels who've flown all this time in combat how to fly these planes that they didn't know how to fly.
Well, that's true.
Pretty wild.
Yeah, it was a nice job. I really enjoyed I spent almost 3 years there instructing. Then I managed to get out of there to the F-86 training at Williams, Arizona. And from there, I went up to F-100s in Nellis. And then I went over to Clark Air Base in the Philippines to a F-100 squadron. And we stood nuclear alert up on Tainan Island, Formosa. We were standing nuclear alert, and I was combat ready, except I didn't know how to play bridge. So before they put me on alert, to stand nuclear alert, I had to learn how to play bridge.
Seems like an odd requirement.
Yeah, it was.
And explain to the layperson what that means practically when you're on nuclear alert. What's the significance?
You're sitting there, there's a foursome, and your airplanes are all ready to go. And when the buzzer goes off, you got 7 or 8 minutes to get airborne. We were going to go bomb with a nuclear weapon on board.
So you're standing by to help end the world.
Well, fight for our cause.
I mean, I say it that way. That seems like a heavy responsibility on your shoulders.
Well, it was, but you stood in a nuclear alert. You had your target. Sometimes you had to refuel first, meet your tanker and refuel, and then hit on in.
So there were times you were airborne with a nuclear weapon?
No, you never got airborne. The runway was always blocked. Okay. And anytime we had a snow, there was always a red light out there, a car on the runway blocking anybody from taking off. But thank God they didn't ever leave the runway open for us to take off. That meant that we were on our way.
It's just a reminder, you know, that of all the things that happened, there are things that didn't happen that would be really significant.
And that brings to mind a question that I'm going to ask Bob when we come back. If you'd like to see what this decorated fighter pilot looked like then, or what he looks like now, you can head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.